Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak about President Bush's latest assertion that the United States will stay in Iraq as long as it stayed in Korea. And we'll try and understand what the president meant, because it's difficult to see the Iraq government, a Shiite-dominated government, more friendly to Iran than it is to the United States, being anything like the South Korean government. But we'll investigate that idea, along with a general inquiry into what's happening in Iraq. General Odom, who's been on this program a number of times, recently has suggested that we shouldn't see Iraq as a civil war, or it is now a regional war, that the intervention in Iraq has caused the jihadis to both flock there and then export their mayhem. And we'll be looking into that with Nir Rosen, who is an Israeli-American journalist. He speaks Arabic. He's spent, over the last few years, he's been in and out of post-war Iraq, reporting on the American occupation and its relationship between the Americans and the Iraqis. He actually spends time with Iraqis. He's even interviewed a number of the insurgents. He's written a book on Iraq, In the Belly of the Green Bird, The Triumph of the Martyrs in Iraq. And he'll be joining us in a little while. And then we will talk to Dr. R.J. Hillhouse, who's a former professor and Fulbright Fellow, who now specializes in the study of the privatization of black budgets and U.S. intelligence operations and analysis. And we're all aware of the extent to which the Pentagon has been outsourced through contractors. Apparently the only beneficiaries of the Iraq war so far are the Halliburtons, and they are getting quite a bit of attention, but very little attention has been paid to the outsourcing of intelligence. And now apparently up to 70% of the $42 billion plus intelligence budget is privatized. So Dr. Hillhouse will be joining us. Her blog is The Spy Who Billed Me. And it's been praised by a number of sources, including the New York Times and the LA Times Online. And she'll be joining us to talk about this little studied phenomenon. And she's also writing a book, spy thriller, Outsourced, which will be coming out soon. And then we'll speak with Nina Ognjenova, who is the European and Central Asian Research Associate for the Committee to Protect Journalists. She just spent last week in Moscow. She went there to represent the Committee to Protect Journalists, and there was a meeting in Moscow of a group of international journalists. The meeting was under the auspices of the International Federation of Journalists, and the former Soviet leader Gorbachev spoke to a lot of the foreign journalists there about the assassination of Anna Politkovskaya, who was a subject of a lot of the discussions, and her, of course, her brutal murder remains unsolved, as indeed most of the deaths of journalists. But we're talking to Nina about her impressions of the death of Russian journalism. One of the studies presented by the head of the by Igor Yakovenko, who's the general secretary of the Russian Union of Journalists, his study entitled "The Torn Profession," says that back in 2000, roughly 30% of television and radio was devoted to praising the Kremlin or the leadership. Now that total has risen to 92% in 2006 of coverage in the media is designed to praise the leadership, rather like Fox News operates here in the United States. Now let's go to the subject of Iraq. I'm speaking with Nir Rosen, who's a journalist who's written extensively on the American presence in Afghanistan and Iraq. And Mr. Rosen has spent more than a year in post-war Iraq reporting on the American occupation and our relations with Iraqis and the development of the post-war Iraqi religious and political movements. And you've also written a book in the belly of the green bird, the triumph of the martyrs in Iraq. And we've spoken as this tragedy has unfolded in Iraq near Rosen. And one of the things that you predicted some time ago was that, in effect, our blunder into Iraq is creating a kind of a regional export of jihadis. In effect, we are just another militia. In fact, worse than that, we're become a training ground, target practice, if you will, for jihadis. Now, I understand that there's evidence that of what you've suggested has come true, unfortunately, in Lebanon. There's evidence that the Fatah al-Islam group inside the Palestinian refugee camp are, in fact, foreign fighters from Iraq, all battle-hardened by their experience fighting the army and Marines.
That's true. It's not actually a Palestinian organization. It's, in fact, the relevance of Iraq goes even farther, in that Fatah al-Islam was actually supported by the Sunni government of Lebanon, by Prime Minister Fuad Senoura, by Saad al-Hariri, the son of the late Prime Minister. They actually supported Fatah al-Islam and other radical Sunni movements to counter what they perceived as the a powerful Shia Hezbollah organization, and they felt threatened by that. And they were seeing things in the context of Iraq, Sunni versus Shia, and they needed their own Sunni militia, and they actually ended up supporting these radical Sunnis. So, indeed, I think the conflict has already spread. And, in fact, in Lebanon, after the execution of Saddam, we saw posters of Saddam all over the walls of Sunni neighborhoods. He had become a Sunni symbol even in Lebanon.
So is this part of a wider strategy on the part of the United States and apparently with Saudi and Jordanian help to blunt what they perceive as the Shia crescent, the export of and the empowerment of Iran by funding, training a kind of Sunni response to Shia, the growth of Shiism, particularly in the form of Hezbollah?
Well, I'm not sure if America is driving this or if some of the powerful Sunni Arab countries in the region are driving this out of fear of increased Shia strength in the region. I think it's more likely being driven by some of the Sunni neighbors as America's influence in the region actually weakens. I also think that with the failure of the surge in Iraq, America is sort of surging in Lebanon and Palestine, funding the Lebanese security forces, provoking a civil war in Gaza. But I don't think this is an American-driven thing necessarily.
Well, that's some of the reporting of Seymour Hersh suggested that it was a kind of a plan on the part of the CIA that's already in the category of blowback, in the sense that they've created a worse monster in terms of the Sunni extremism. There's obviously the United States is flying arms in. There's no question about that.
Well, we are definitely supporting the Lebanese government to the extent that it has a government, and it's Sunni-dominated internal security forces. And our key allies in Lebanon are Sunnis, and they are the ones who, in turn, have been funding these radical Sunni organizations. So Seymour Hersh is certainly correct in that sense. I just don't think that you could say the Americans are themselves funding radical Sunnis. It's more that the American proxies are funding the radical Sunnis.
And the country that you are most concerned about in terms of being destabilized by the Iraq war is Jordan. And what's your reading on what's happening there? Because it seems that the Sunni, at least as a part of the Sunni opposition to the United States and to the Shia domination of Iraq, is probably the former Baathists are pretty much organized out of Jordan, aren't they? So that would suggest, I understand that there's been long-standing relationship between the Jordanian army and Saddam's Baathist army.
Well, it's Syria and Jordan. Now, the Jordanian army, of course, is a very close ally both of the American and even the Israeli army. So it's not so much the Jordanian army that would be a concern. It's the fact that Jordan is just not as stable as it seems. The king isn't as popular as his father is. He doesn't have the same legitimacy. He's perceived as being too close to the Americans and the Israelis. He's perceived they're not speaking Arabic well enough. There are allegations of corruption involving land deals. It's a very fragile system there. Half of the population is Palestinian, only 5 million people, and you've just injected another million Iraqis. So while I don't think anything will happen anytime soon, I think you sort of have the perfect storm there, or all the factors for the perfect storm. And likewise in Syria, a majority Sunni country dominated by a small sect that comes from Shias. And the Sunnis in Syria are very sympathetic with their Sunni brethren. In Iraq, you have over a million Iraqi refugees in Syria. In both countries, Syria and Jordan, you have strong Sunni Islamist opposition movements. So again, all the ingredients are there for a catastrophe. And I think something like in Lebanon would be the perfect spark. You hear Israel lately talking about a potential war with Syria. And I think once there is a real genocide of Sunnis in Baghdad, you'll see increased involvement of Jordanians and Saudis. So I don't think anything will happen immediately, but I do think that the entire region will really be shaken up by all this.
And if there's already ethnic cleansing going on of the Sunni out of Baghdad, if it gets to the point where they appear to be facing defeat, your concern is that the leftovers, the people that are trained, armed, and financed probably by the Saudis are going to turn their frustration somewhere else. Now, if the Assad government has a relationship with the Iranians, aren't they the enemy of the Sunni?
They're in a very difficult position in that, yes, they are an ally of the Iranians. At the same time, they also support the Iraqi government, which is similarly accused of being an Iranian proxy. And they, of course, also support Hezbollah, the Shia guerrilla and political organization in Lebanon. So there is bound to be resentment of the Syrians. However, the Syrians are also the most welcoming to Sunni refugees, or to refugees in general, in the region. So they have that going for them. And they also have a very strong security apparatus, which has so far prevented any real organization or mobilization. But the refugees are still very new. It's only been a couple of years that we've had this crisis. And they're still in shock. I think it'll take a little more time for them to get organized and mobilized. We have to think in terms of the Palestinian refugee crisis. It took them about a decade to really organize themselves in militias and so forth. So this will take a little bit of time before all hell breaks loose.
And in terms of what's happening now in Iraq, obviously the president is almost guilty of magical thinking that somehow General David Petraeus will work miracles by September. And the reports you're getting now, and I know you contribute to IraqSlogger.com, which is one of the more authoritative websites that does in-depth coverage of the day-to-day activities inside Iraq. I believe General Petraeus reads it every day. So there's been reports that some of the troops, the American troops fighting this war, particularly the younger and junior officers, are complaining that the surge is happening in the opposite direction. It's the enemy that's surging.
I would agree. Even calling it a surge on the American part is just very dishonest. I think you could call it an ooze. It would be better because it took several months to accomplish. It was only a 15% increase, and many of these troops weren't even new troops. They were merely old troops who were being forced to stay longer. And from the American point of view, you've now doubled your enemies. Not only are you fighting Sunnis, but you're now also fighting Shias, the majority of Iraq. So you've doubled your enemies, but you've only increased your troops by 15%. It's a joke. You can't possibly hope to accomplish anything. And it also fails to recognize that the occupation was always the main problem in Iraq. The American presence was always the main problem, and that there really isn't much the Americans can do.
So they're basically, these soldiers leave their bases and drive around, and if they're not blown up, they're sniped at. I mean, it must be wearing on them, because I don't see a strategy here.
No, there is none. The strategy is to buy time and give it to the next president. I mean, it's absolutely criminal. These American soldiers are dying for nothing, or they're dying so we can say that the other ones who died before them didn't die in vain. But in fact, they're all dying for absolutely nothing. There's not going to be a victory. There's not going to be anything remotely resembling a positive outcome. And the longer we're there, the worse things are.
And Nir Rosen, is it likely that these incursions into Sadr City are likely to provoke an all-out war with the biggest Shiite militia, the Muqtada Sadr?
I think Muqtada Sadr is very smart, and he realizes that the Americans are going to leave one day. And why take them on and lose so many of your fighters when you can just wait them out and then take over the country? So I don't think that there's going to be a full-scale conflict. I think, obviously, there will be some skirmishes. But he's been very good at lying low and having his men lie low, waiting for the Americans to leave so he can take on the Sunnis.
And basically, he's keeping his powder dry because he'll be the biggest militia outside of what's called the Iraqi army, which is largely a Shia army at any rate.
Yes.
So when the president, Nir Rosen, says that our presence in Iraq will be similar to our continuing presence in South Korea, I don't get it. First of all, as far as
nobody
I know,
gets it. There's no comparison at all.
Well, we don't have, I mean, if the Iraqi government, the Shia government that's closer to Iran than to America, is anything, I can't see that they're anything like the South Korean government. And from what the impression I get is that, in fact, things could actually get worse there, and this could be more like Vietnam than Iraq, that we could eventually get driven out.
Well, I don't think that the U.S. will ever withdraw fully. There are vast bases in the middle of the desert in the Anbar province that are impregnable, that are far from villages, and that are basically built to last forever. I've been to them, and you feel like you're in America. So there is going to be what they've been calling an enduring presence in some of these large bases in the middle of nowhere.
How could you service those bases? How could you service them apart from by air?
Yeah, indeed, by air. It is going to be difficult. It is going to be a perpetual war. But I do not think the Americans will ever fully withdraw from Iraq. I think they'll end up leaving the cities. But it's hard for me to envision a withdrawal.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles this morning, Nir Rosen.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with the Israeli-American journalist Nir Rosen. Spent a lot of time in Iraq, speaks Arabic, and unfortunately he was running late for a meeting. I wanted to ask him more about, particularly about an article in Sunday's New York Times Week in Review by Edward Wong, who's been over there for some time. Just the first paragraph of this article: perhaps no fact is more revealing about Iraq's history than this. The Iraqis have a word that means to utterly defeat and humiliate someone by dragging his corpse through the street. The word is Sahel, and it helps explain much of what I have seen in 3.5 years covering the war in Iraq. And Perhaps the two draft dodgers in the White House would be prepared to turn the United States military into the equivalent of the SS in World War II and bring about a victory through blood and mayhem. But the U.S. military, of course, wouldn't stand for that. So it's an interesting subject to cover. Perhaps we'll see if we can get Edward Wong on a later program. And I'm now speaking with Dr. R.J. Hillhouse, who's a former professor and Fulbright Fellow who specializes in the study of the privatization of black budget U.S. intelligence operations and analysis. And now, of course, we've learned that up to 70% of the $42-plus billion intelligence budget is now being privatized. Her popular blog, The Spy Who Billed Me, has been praised by numerous sources, including the New York Times and L.A. Times Online. And she is now finishing up a spy thriller, Outsourced, which will be in bookstores. Actually, it's arriving in bookstores now, about the turf wars between the Pentagon and the CIA and the privatization of national security. And, of course, we've heard much about the privatization of the Pentagon through contractors such as Halliburton, the vice president's oil company. That's all in the public record. And obviously, at this point, the only beneficiaries of the agony in Iraq appear to be the big contractors. But there was a bit of a hint of intelligence contractors during the Abu Ghraib scandal. But I understand this is more than the nose of the camel here. From 1995, about $18 billion of the budget is in private hands, and now in 2005, it's up to $42 billion. So give us a sense of who these people are that are being contracted out to, and who do they report to?
The $42 billion figure would include the National Security Agency and all the imaging and a lot of the hardware. So it goes to a lot of that. And then there's the human intelligence industry, which is a much more interesting side of the privatization story, because we already know a little bit about the National Security Agency. When few people were looking, the CIA has been privatized for all practical purposes. And it's been a very different trend than has been going on with the military. The military has privatized non-core functions, which is perimeter security, logistics, things along that line, whereas what's happened with the CIA is some of their main human intelligence gathering has been privatized, and it's in the hands of corporations now run by former CIA officers.
Who do they report to? I mean, in other words, the company that contracts you out, they're your client, not the United States government.
What goes on within the CIA, they contract out for specific services, which can include basically running of entire branches or parts of the National Clandestine Service or the former DO. They will have their own layers of reporting, so it's the whole service or the whole different things that they're doing for spying get reported up through their own chain of command with the company to one person within the CIA who presumably is a CIA employee, but in some cases appears might also be another contractor from another company.
And I understand that because there's more money in being a private contractor, a lot of people are leaving the agency. There's a revolving door going on there where they leave the agency, then they contract back to the agency.
Yes, it's very true. The agency's been hemorrhaging. Now, this has been going on for several years, but it appears that it's gotten even worse in the last few months. General Hayden, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, last Thursday told USA Today that 15% of the CIA's workforce had been hired within the last 2 months, which is a totally astonishing figure to have that many new. He, of course, was trying to put a good spin on it, that the CIA is the youngest it's ever been. You can also read that it's the most inexperienced it's ever been. Also on Friday, which hasn't been picked up by the media, they have now trying to slow down the outflow of people by having a cooling off period implemented, which you can't work for the agency for 18 months now until back as a contractor. I'm sorry, until after you, 15, sorry about that, 18 months until after you've left. So there is a waiting period, which this is too slow of measure, far too late. It's closing the barn door after the horse and the cow and just about everything else has already left. Should have been implemented about 5 years ago.
But essentially the CIA finds itself in competition with its contractors for its own employees.
Yes. It's been losing its employees. I mean, there have been instances where companies have been caught wining and dining CIA employees in the CIA cafeteria in order to get them to leave their job and come back and work for their company, but then be leased back to the CIA, basically doing the exact same job. I mean, what was happening is people were working one day as an employee of the U.S. government, and then the next day they would be coming back doing the exact same work for tens of thousands of dollars more, working for a private company. Private company that, of course, had several layers of markup for administration and for profit, et cetera.
Well, some of these private contractors, like Science Applications International, which is one of the biggest intelligence contractors,
yes.
The Science Applications International spent over $1.3 million on their congressional lobbying efforts in 2006. Mm-hmm. So here you have private contractors lobbying the government for contracts. At the same time, the government presumably doesn't have the same kind of oversight over these contractors that the Senate Select Intelligence and House Select Intelligence Committee has over the government employees.
Yeah, that's correct. And then you have the whole larger question of, as you said, this is all working within the intelligence community, which is very secretive, and it's easy to hide some of the things that are going on under the veil of national security. We saw a study came out in late April of this year that had been commissioned over a year ago by the Director of National Intelligence, and it was a former director who commissioned it, Negroponte, who had was very rare because he had no ties to the industry. He left. The new director, Mike McConnell, is very much coming out of the industry. He's a former chairman of the industry's lobby. He came in from one of the large consulting corporations that works for the industry. The study was very controversial, and they were unable to sanitize it or censor it enough to keep from embarrassing themselves. So rather than allow the public to see the extent of outsourcing in the intelligence community, the extent of outsourcing in the CIA and the effect that it's had, they censored the study by saying the number of contractors was a matter of national security. So suddenly a study that was supposed to be released was suddenly stopped and pulled back.
Well,
so it's very easy to hide these type of things that are going on.
So is it reasonable to assume that in the Randy Duke Cunningham case, where he accepted, is convicted of accepting more than $2 million in bribes from executives of MZM, which was a San Diego defense contractor, they were working on intelligence contracts, and they had apparently established a relationship with Kyle Dusty Fargo, who was one of the who was the number three guy in the CIA. Actually, former deputy director of the CIA, and he was indicted for conspiracy along with Brent Wilkes. Now, that case, of course, the U.S. attorney that was looking into that, Carol Lam, was fired by Gonzalez, and that remains to be seen whether and that was a political firing, although the assumption is it was. So that whole case there, is that do you think this it's more widespread than what we've learned from just that one particular case?
You know, the answer is we don't know, and we can't know unless this is looked into more closely. I mean, there are clearly excesses going on. There are clearly abuses, whether they're on the level and some of the gross level of what went on with the Fargo-Wilkes-Cunningham scandal. That's unclear. But are there abuses going on? Are there all types of overcharges going on? I'm sure of that.
So what is driving this? Is this the sort of ideology of the sort of right wing free marketeers, the Grover Norquists who want to shrink the budget, the government down to such a size you could drown it in a bathtub? Is this just a result of that bizarre ideology, or is this indeed basically an extension of what's happened with the defense budget, where the contractors like it when they can write their own ticket?
You know, and that's a very interesting question, because it seems to be parallel trends that have gone on with the privatization of military, which has led to the rise of companies such as Blackwater USA, Triple Canopy, and the other private military corporations. But it seems to be have very distinct origins that are separate from the Rumsfeld-Cheney-Bush agenda toward privatization. Which the private military was clearly part of that in the Pentagon. Within the intelligence community, the trend actually predates this and predates 9/11. And it seems to be, in one interpretation, is it was many people, some of the best and the brightest that the CIA has ever produced, became very frustrated with the political leadership and some of the very restrictive HR policy, human resources policies, and morale problems and other things that they felt was preventing them from doing their job. So in many ways, they were able to use their positions to maneuver things to set up the possibilities for outsourcing and then outsource it to themselves or outsource different things to their friends. So what in effect has occurred is entire, use a simple term, departments or units have been handed over to the private sector or to these former CIA case officers who are, running the show and calling the shots, and they're suddenly, not part of the larger bureaucracy or not restricted by the bureaucracy. So I think the reason or the motives behind it, of course, making money was clearly a motive, it's part of it, but I think a big motive was to save the CIA from itself and its own politics.
And of course, this is distinct from an activity that the CIA has been involved in some time, which is these commercial fronts, these proprietaries that they set up. You know, Valerie Wilson, for example, from the Scooter Libby trial, who was outed by the White House, she worked under commercial cover as a what they call a NOC, non-official cover. But so these big companies are well known. They're all up. They're all in that area of Northern Virginia, mostly. So, what about counterintelligence? What kind of security do they have in terms of being penetrated?
You know, because all of this is very black, that's quite unclear. But it is clear that one company does run some counterintelligence programs for the CIA. That was mentioned in a Time magazine article by former case officer Bob Baer, that a private company is, you know, doing the counterintelligence and telling case officers with whom they can meet and not meet, at least in the case of Baghdad. As to who's doing it within these companies, I assume that companies have to have policies on their own to protect against that. But it does raise some very interesting national security questions, doesn't it?
Well, it does. I mean, you know, the defense contractors obviously have their own security, but it's usually regulated by the government. You're vetted essentially by the government, not by private entities. So I'm just wondering what their level of counterintelligence capability is in terms of being, you know, companies that could be, I think, much more easily penetrated than the CIA.
They can be more easily penetrated, I would argue, and you've also got the problem that companies lose contracts. So suddenly you've got people who, when they work for the CIA, were very stable in their positions and very loyal, as part of the overall CIA family, and now suddenly they find themselves out of jobs and having to scurry from one job to the other in what is, in essence, a giant game of musical chairs. And in the end, there are never enough chairs when the music stops, so you end up with unemployed spies who are trained in some of the most secret procedures or operations that our federal government has ever done. And they're, when unemployed spies are available, the people get desperate for money, and then that raises the whole counterintelligence question. Those are people who could be recruited by other companies for internal secrets from the places that they used to work for, or they could be recruited by foreign powers, or, someday the bad guys are going to clue in.
Or, of course, recruited by Hollywood too.
Hollywood would always be a possibility.
Right, but seriously, isn't there something? I mean, I'm wonder about what will happen to all these private armies like Blackwater and Triple Canopy and others once the Iraq War is over, and it may well be over sooner than we think, in spite of the president's idea that it'll be going as long as the occupation of South Korea, but. If indeed it is over soon, what happens to those private armies? And equally, what happens to these private CIA operations? You touched on it a little bit a moment ago, but does that bother you?
It's very much a concern what will happen to them. I think it's also very much a concern with these companies, as we see some of them, like Blackwater USA, trying to position itself for humanitarian work, security work through the UN, which probably isn't actually a bad idea to be able to get security on the ground very quickly in places like Darfur and make a difference in the human tragedy. In terms of and where some of the people will go and some of the soldiers who have worked for these companies, that's always a concern. Many of them are from third world countries, so presumably they won't all be coming back to the U.S., but they'll also be going back to their home countries. Once they're demobilized, how they will integrate without the usual support structures that military would have in a situation like that, that's a concern. In terms of what will happen with the private intelligence industry, the war on terror will still be around. So I don't think they're going to be affected quite as badly if Iraq were indeed to come to an end for the U.S., which I'm not as optimistic as you are on that one.
Well, again, let me remind the audience, I'm speaking with Dr. R.J. Hillhouse, who's a former professor and Fulbright fellow who specializes in the study of the privatization of black budgets, U.S. intelligence operations and analysis. And, of course, We're talking about this in the context of 70% now of the $42 billion plus intelligence budget has been privatized. Her blog is The Spy Who Billed Me, and she's also got a spy thriller out now, Outsourced, which is about the turf wars between the Pentagon and the CIA and the privatization of national security. But just in terms of the of political mischief and the idea, you know, going back to Randy Duke Cunningham and the corruption issue, Representative Rick Renzi, who's a Republican from Arizona, recently resigned from the House Intelligence Committee back in April because he, and he's under federal investigation for introducing legislation that would have benefited Mantech International, which is a major intelligence contractor, where Renzi's own father worked as a senior executive. So there's a pretty flagrant example of how this whole system could be incredibly corrupted.
Yeah, anytime you have at least $34 billion floating around where it's not clearly accounted for and audited and open to some form of public transparency, things like this could go on.
And the apparently there is some efforts now to clean this up, or at least to have some transparency. Both the House and Senate Intelligence, there are bills for this current year, which is the U.S. intelligence budget is for the next year is $48 billion by most estimates. And apparently this will help, at least these two bills in their forms will help. What do you know about these bills? And obviously the contractors are probably going to lobby against them, aren't they?
I believe what there were pushes to try to have the top line budget, which would be the overall size of the intelligence community budget, made public. And I thought the latest status was they weren't doing very well, and it didn't look like it would happen. But I'm not sure having an overall amount that is spent on contractors public is really going to make a difference as to, you know, some of the financial excesses that appear to go on at some times.
So, Dr. Hillhouse, how do you do your research if this private world is even more secret than the secret world of the National Security Agency, the CIA, and the other alphabet soup of agencies there in Washington? You know, I know from various reporters and investigators, journalists I've spoken to on the military contracting side. Robert Young Pelton did a book on contractors, License to Kill. And he actually spent years trying to get an interview with Prince, the head of Blackwater, eventually did. Others have never gotten near these guys. So they're a much tougher nut to crack. So I'm just wondering how you can, you know, do your work with your blog, the Spy Who Billed Me.
Well, I actually did get an interview with the president of Blackwater, Gary Jackson, a couple of months ago that was picked up in the New York Times. It's taken persistence, connections, and if I told you, because in order to do the novel, in some ways people have been more willing to talk to me because I'm working on a level of fiction for Outsourced. And then, of course, for the blog, that's on the nonfiction side, so that makes it a little bit more challenging. But, you know, it's one of those areas that if I told you any more about it, as the old joke goes, if I told you, I'd have to, I guess in this case, hire a private intelligence company to kill you.
Join the queue. So, but we've known for some time that a huge chunk, as you mentioned in the opening statements, Dr. Hillhouse, that the earlier, we've had these black budgets for huge programs of satellites, starting with TRW and Hughes, and that's been going on for some time. And the technical means side of intelligence, the signaled intelligence, is nobody much challenges that. We don't necessarily know a lot about it and how the contracts are monitored. I believe that there have been some cases where there's been some massive boondoggles with a huge spy satellite system. I'm not sure they ended up canceling it because it was such a boondoggle. But again, I'm not sure about that. But on the human intelligence side, there's a lot of activity going on, and that's the side that's actually more worrying, particularly if indeed the CIA has put itself in a situation where it's almost putting itself out of business by creating competition that's draining its own resources. So that's what you've told us so far, right?
Yes. I mean, the CIA's been gutted. The best and the brightest and even the next couple of tiers down have all left the agency to private companies and are leasing back their services to the CIA. So what we've seen is the expertise is no longer in the hands of the expertise of the black arts of espionage are no longer in the hands of the federal government, but in the hands of private corporations. So the institution itself has lost the knowledge. Yeah. And the contractors are the one that understand the business, that understand what they're doing far better than the new young guys that have been hired or who are even overseeing the contracts. And then when you get into the next generations, it gets scarier and scarier. You know, it's hearing that we've got the youngest CIA cadre ever is not reassuring by any means. And it appears that within the most important part of the human intelligence gathering arm of the CIA, the National Clandestine Service, that between 50% to 60% of the workforce work for private corporations.
And this is a separate from the notion that big corporations have their own industrial espionage operations. But presumably, those kind of things will be enhanced by this kind of skill sets that are out there, right?
Right. That brings up a very fascinating question, because all of these companies, I mean, they work for the U.S. government, but they also offer their services to other companies. Some market specifically to Fortune 500 companies. Most all of them, if you'll even see on their websites, market to foreign governments as well.
Mm.
So that brings up a host of national security issues and conflicts of interest. And then you've got the other side of it, that some of them are at least partially, if not wholly, foreign-owned.
Right. And they have considerably more laxed screening methods and thresholds for, you know, it's pretty hard to get into the CIA, even though they're desperate for Arabic-speaking people. You know, we know about cases of people being fired for their sexual preferences and other things.
In the military, uh-huh.
Yeah. But so in other words, then if the barrier is a lot lower in the corporate world, that it may be a good thing. But on the other hand, it certainly opens them up to the idea of being penetrated, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's going to become more and more the case. Currently, the workforce of the corporate world is poached from the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
So those are people who have, because they're bringing, they want the people in who are experienced, not young new people that they have to train themselves. Because it's been more the case that let the CIA, let the government pay for this extensive training and then headhunt them and bring them into industry. And, of course, Hayden's rule, 18-month cooling-off period from Friday, is apparently to try to stem that tide, although, as I said, it's about 5-6 years too late.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're going to see in the next several years, when they can no longer get the workforce from the agency, because they've already taken out all the best people who aren't, you know, just waiting their last few years so they can retire and get a pension. So they're going to have to start training their own cadre or their own workforce. So I understand some companies are even looking at setting up their own quasi-training academies or their own version of the farm that the CIA uses for training in order to have skilled workforce.
Mm.
And so those people will be, of course, instilled with corporate values.
Right.
Not
well, you know,
values of U.S. government service. And
right.
So we're going to see some very interesting.
And one of the main corporate values is how you bribe the government to get the contract in the first place. And it turns out you don't have to have any special skills if you look at what happened with the outsourcing at Walter Reed.
In this case, I think you do need to have very separate skills.
Yeah.
There are only very few people that can provide these skills.
Sure.
And they're the people that used to provide these skills for the U.S. government. So it's a case that there doesn't need to be any type of bribery
right.
to get the contract, because you're often the only guy that can do it, or you and
right.
you know your deputy who's now working for another company, so those two are competing for
sure.
it.
Well, Dr. Hillis, I thank you very much for joining us, and your blog is The Spy Who Billed Me, right?
Yes, it is.
.org?
Or .com.
.com, The Spy Who Billed Me. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Dr. Archie Hillhouse, who studies black budgets and U.S. intelligence operations and their privatization, and her blog is The Spy Who Billed Me. I'm now speaking with Nina Ognjenova, who is the Europe and Central Asia Research Associate for the Committee to Protect Journalists, and she's just back from Moscow, where she spent the last week. There was a conference in Moscow organized by the International Federation of Journalists, which is a Brussels-based private organization. And Nina, what was the general tone of, if you will, of the journalists present there? They've got to be a pretty sad bunch, aren't they? The reporters in Russia, the extent to which they had during the Yeltsin period, there was a period of tremendous openness, and now apparently it's all but closed down, and now you're required to be a propagandist, not a journalist.
Well, I mean, yeah, the International Federation of Journalists is a Brussels-based private organization, and it held its 26th Congress in Moscow this past week. The Congress itself managed to gather journalists and media workers from about 150 countries. So it was a pretty big gathering, and the Federation had selected Moscow for this Congress for the reason that it wanted to bring attention to the increasingly repressive environment for Russian journalists, incidentally, the Congress started with a session on impunity in journalist murders, because it just so happens that Russia has suffered the loss of 47 journalists in the past 15 years. 47 journalists have been killed in direct reprisal for their reporting.
This is not like being shot in Iraq. These are targeted killings. These people have been assassinated.
Exactly. I mean, Russia, according to CPJ research, is the third deadliest country for reporters in the world, after Iraq, where there is an ongoing war, and after Algeria, when it was torn by a civil war. But Russia is a nominally peaceful country, and it still has suffered a tremendous death toll, 47 journalists in the past 15 years.
And most of them were killed, I understand, for investigating high officials. Occasionally, some were killed by investigations into gangsters. But isn't that a problem in Russia, where the kind of KGB and the gangsters have appear to be one in the same in terms of who's running the place?
I mean, that's correct. In the past 6 years alone, 17 journalists have been killed in Russia in the line of duty. 14 have been murdered in response to their professional work. 2 have died in crossfire, and 1 has perished while covering a dangerous assignment. In addition, we are investigating another 8 deaths for possible connection to their work. And out of these 25 killings that have happened since 2000, 13 bear the marks of contract hits. And we consider a contract-style killing a death when there is evidence that shows that the murder was carried out by an assassin, one or more assassins, at the behest of one or more masterminds.
Well, of course, the most famous of those assassinations was Anna Politkovskaya, and she was a subject of a lot of the discussion. Apparently, former Soviet General Secretary Gorbachev attended a discussion about her and her legacy with her son. I understand that Novaya Gazeta, which is the only independent newspaper, albeit a small one, it's not censored or toting up to the government, mm-hmm. have done their in separate inquiry into her assassination. They're prepared to reveal what they believe indicates official sanctions to her death, but they're waiting for the inquiry. So what? Give us a sense of where that inquiry is going and the extent to which Gorbachev spoke about it.
I mean, Gorbachev was invited to speak at the Congress itself, but there was some last-minute emergency, and he couldn't speak at the Congress itself, but he did speak at an event dedicated to the publishing of Anna Politkovskaya's posthumous collection of articles and commentary called For What? It was launched on May 30th, on Wednesday, and Gorbachev, who is in fact a partial owner of Novaya Gazeta, spoke at that event. He did express his concern about the ongoing investigation and the fact that the investigation has yet not produced any results, and 8 months have passed since the contract-style murder of Politkovskaya in October. From my conversations with Nova Gazeta and from our own research, both our colleagues at Nova Gazeta and we at CPJ are concerned that that the investigation might be derailed for political reasons, and that there isn't enough political will to in fact go in the right in the right track, but that law enforcement officials may or may not, we don't know yet, of course, announce that this is a killing that was fabricated by enemies of the Russian state abroad, and the unspoken word is that Berezovsky will be personally blamed for it as the organizer.
Mm. Well, he's also getting blamed for the Litvinenko killing as well by yeah. the Kremlin. So that seems to be their yeah. Their standard MO. But
I mean, we can't say that for sure because the investigation has not made any sure. official official indication of what the results are or what the progress is.
Sure. Well, the guy that was just that the British just indicted as the author of the polonium radioactive killing of Litvinenko in London. He had a press conference
and aggressive press conference.
Right, where he said that I'm a victim of the special services of the British. So, but this conference itself and Novaya Gazeta, which is with the independent paper, has less than 200,000 circulation. There was no press coverage in Russia of what was going on, I take it. And since the only paper that sort of tells the truth, if you will, has less than $200,000 circulation, mm-hmm. it's pretty grim, isn't it, in terms of what the average Russian...
It's really grim, and I mean, it's the fact is that as the country nears parliamentary and presidential elections, the Kremlin has intensified its effort to just neutralize any dissent, any opposition views. Criticizing state officials, it's basically impossible to have mainstream media. The independent reporting is entirely exiled from the influential mainstream media, and only finds a home in the alternative press. Those are the websites, the news websites online, and the small circulation newspapers, which have less influence on public opinion. Most of the public in Russia gets its news from national television, and all three national television channels are controlled by the Kremlin. So the state successfully shapes up public opinion, and opposing views have little chance of reaching a broad audience.
And this has been cataloged and written about by the General Secretary of the Russian Union of Journalists, mm-hmm. Igor Yakovenko, who's written a pamphlet, I guess, entitled The Torn Profession, roughly 30% of the total amount of information in 2000 was pro-government, pro-president, mm-hmm. pro-ruling party. That has risen to 92% in 2006. So Putin is writes his own reviews, I guess.
criticizing state officials in Russia has some dear repercussions for those who dare to do so. Russia's criminal code contains defamation and insult articles. They carry prison sentences for the convicted. Mm. Last July, President Putin signed some amendments to the law on fighting extremist activity, which broadens the definition of extremism to include media criticism of public officials. And the new legislation allows imprisonment for up to 3 years for journalists and the suspension or closure of their publications if those are convicted of extremism.
Well, now, Nina, do you think that President Bush is going to talk about this? He's meeting with Putin in Germany, and he's got a scheduled meeting at the family, the Bush family, Kennebunkport compound on July the 1st. sometimes I watch President Bush's press conference, and I think probably he'd like to be able to have the kind of squelch the press like Putin. They've done a pretty good job over here, but obviously there's no comparison. But the main thing is, I guess, you know, we've witnessed the clock turn back in Russia, and it doesn't seem like anybody in the United States has put any pressure, any moral suasion at all. This has all been happening. The KGB gangsters have taken over the country. It's you know, the KGB itself is now a sort of police arming, the enforcement arm of a kind of oligarchy that Putin and his cronies have set up. So it's all happened in plain sight. We've seen a country literally stolen by political gangsters.
Well, I mean, it's true that the U.S. hasn't been critical enough, and yet Russia and the Russian administration keeps upping up the rhetoric of that the U.S. Is applying, called war rhetoric, even with the little criticism present. But I do think that President Bush has to address the issue of press freedom and of human rights and of civil rights at his meeting with his Russian counterparts, in the run-up to elections in Russia.
Sure, of course, the tragedy is that President Bush is so unpopular, and he's made America so unpopular throughout the world, and conversely, Putin is incredibly popular within Russia.
He's incredibly popular, that's true. He has 70% positive rating in the polls, but it's partially because the opposition views are entirely exiled from the media, so they the Russian public cannot see their alternative alternative to Putin and his administration. The alternative views have been entirely forbidden and airbrushed from the public space. Mm. So that is partially why Mr. Putin has managed to remain so popular.
I thank you very much for joining us. I'm sorry we've run out of time, Nina Agnianova, but I really appreciate your joining us and giving us your experiences from your recent trip to Moscow.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Nina Agnianova, who is the European and Central Asian Research Associate at the Committee to Protect Journalists. She was in Moscow. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Elliot Fong, the assistant producer, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.